Morning, everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. This morning, we have another joint session with our sister brother committee, whatever it is, down the hall. And welcome, everybody. I'd like to take the roll call of the House State Affairs Committee, and then we'll turn the gavel over to my colleague and friend, Senator Dyson, and he will be the one who will actually chair the meeting. So please call the roll for the House.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Hughes. Representative Eisenstein.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Millet. Representative Kreis Tonkin.
Here.
Representative, or Chair Lynn.
I am here. Thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to turn the gavel over to Senator Dyson. Good morning, sir.
Thank you. On the Senate side, myself, Dyson, and Senator Kathy Geisel are here. Mr. Coghill and Mr. Wilikowski are in another meeting. Hopefully, will be joining us sooner. And Mr. Stedman is not attending. Please come up, Commissioner. I want to compliment you on the last presentation. And amongst the things I appreciated was what I considered the frankness and integrity and being upfront about the things that aren't right yet. And that builds a lot of credibility with me. We're working off the same packet that we had last week.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I'm also going to ask Emily Cotter to present with me.
Sure.
She is our Strategic Health Initiatives Coordinator.
And she's, excuse me. Go ahead.
She's going to walk through a couple of the slides in here.
Okay. And would you briefly just rehearse what you covered with us last week?
Absolutely.
And where we're going to start.
Mr. Chairman, so last week we started out by kind of setting the stage with looking at what healthcare trends are in the country. Then we moved down a level to look at what state of Alaska healthcare trends have been. And then we began to look at state of Alaska healthcare spending as an enterprise, looking at Medicaid, our plans, the many different areas in the state that where we spend healthcare dollars, and then brought it all the way down to the active employee plan, which is the one that we're going to talk about today. We talked about the premium structure of that plan, how the plan is structured, some of the challenges with that structure, and then ended up on this slide, which looked at the contribution trend in terms of in our country across employers in terms of what the employer typically pays and the employee typically pays.
Excuse me.
No. I'd like to take to Representative Hughes has joined us. Good morning.
So we're going to start this presentation today, and I want to say thank you for having us back. I'm gratified that you found it of value enough for us to come back and present the balance of this. We just really appreciate your interest in these topics because they are a particular challenge to us. So we're grateful to be here today. So today we're going to start from slide 15, and we're going to talk about some experience in our plan. We're going to talk about some of the things that are driving costs in our plan, and then we're going to look at a couple of case studies that from other states and one private sector organization that might help guide us in the future in looking at how we could potentially change our plan to get better outcomes both for our members and for the state from a financial perspective. And Emily's going to walk through those case studies. So this just shows you medical plan expenses for the active employee health plan. Not surprising, they've grown just like the premiums have grown. You see, we had a little bit of a leveling off in 2010 and 11, followed by a bit of a bump in 12. As we had talked about with respect to the premium structure, that seems to be a fairly consistent pattern in our plans, and one that is concerning to us, and I'll explain a little bit more why in a minute. But we tend to see a bit of a leveling off and then a couple of years, followed by a couple of years of big spikes. This graph does not show it as well as some of the graphs did earlier in the presentation with respect to premium. But the concerning part to us is we've seen a bit of a bump in 12, and as we look at the first part of our FY13 experience in the active plan, we're seeing a large jump. So we're not out of the woods. We still have to wrestle with this issue of cost escalation. I don't know that our active plan experience is inconsistent with what we're seeing in the rest of the country. We saw flattening out, I think, for two reasons. One is the Affordable Care Act, not necessarily the provisions of the act, but the fact that we were talking so much in the country about healthcare costs. I think anytime we start to talk about costs, it tends to have somewhat of a depressive effect on those costs. The second reason,
why?
Mr. Chairman, I'm speculating, but I believe as we talk about costs and as we make transparent the costs that we're paying, there's providers take a look at their own costs and perhaps decide this is not the best year for a cost increase. So I think that's probably what's been happening. I also think that because the economy has been so bad and there's been uncertainty, even in Alaska where the economy's been good, there's just been a level of uncertainty there with the stock market, the things that are happening in Washington. People tend to delay care until they feel more certain from an economic standpoint. So I think we're seeing a bit of pent-up demand as well for services that they might have done in previous years that they put off.
Thank you. I suspected that.
So I want to talk a little bit about what drives costs in a plan. And the first driver that's not on the slide, but it's the obvious one, is population. If your employee population grows, of course, you're going to have more costs just because of the population growth. The other two factors that drive cost and that are illustrated on this page are unit pricing and utilization. And let's talk through the impact of unit price and utilization. Now, this is a snapshot in time from our active plan that talks about medical costs per member per month and breaks down what the growth was in those costs per member per month over a one-year time frame. So you can see that from April 2011 to March 2011, a one-year snapshot, to April 2011 to March 2012, another one-year snapshot, our medical per member per month cost went up 4%. Now, 4%, I think, in healthcare is relatively good. We would say, you know, that's certainly better than some of the cost increases we've seen. But here's where the concern comes from and why 4% in this situation isn't very good. Our unit pricing went up 9%. Unit pricing is what did a service cost one year compared to a comparable service next year. So essentially, our rate of medical inflation was 9%. That was counteracted by a change in utilization. So people consumed less care, utilization went down, which in some cases is good because if it's overutilization and people are consuming less healthcare because they don't really need it, that's a good thing. Or if it's appropriate utilization, that's a good thing. But you can't drive utilization down forever because that then becomes negative. You don't want people to delay care to the point where their problems become more expensive, especially if it's primary care. You want them to access primary care. So decline in utilization was good, perhaps, but completely offset and counteracted by a 9% rise in the prices that we paid for things. That 9% graph is the one that we have to get our arms around in the state, and then we have to change. Because until we're seeing that graph at the rate of inflation, our costs are going to continue to rise at an unsustainable level.
Excuse me. Two things. We are, Senate Secretary Nancy Jones is helping us today, and then handling communications is Alex Giudice. Did I say that right, sir?
Giudice.
All right. Thank you, and thanks for your help. Just a second. We hear from the medical providers, particularly the professionals, that our reimbursement rates, you know, are marginal and they can hardly make a living and so on and so forth. What's your take on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think it depends on who you're talking to. I think we tend to lump the providers together as a community, and in fact, they're really not. There are very distinct groups of providers, and their pricing structures, and I suspect, although I've not seen their books, but I suspect that their profit margins are very different. If you look at our hospitals, for example, it's a very different experience. The urban hospitals have a very different experience than our rural hospitals. I think the margins of the smaller hospitals are much smaller than the margins of the large urban hospitals. We have to care for that. We have to be aware of that. Our specialists are very highly compensated. You're going to see that on a slide further in the presentation. So that's where we tend to see the largest divergence in costs between Alaska and our peers in the Pacific Northwest. We see very high divergence in cost on the specialists, We are higher when it comes to primary care, but not near, but by not nearly as large a margin as we are when it comes to specialists. So I think the question of is their compensation appropriate really is dependent upon what kind of a provider you're looking at. And I think from a customer standpoint, we just have to seek value. And while I understand that there are lots of barriers, and whether they're regulatory or legal or other, to lots of challenges, I would say, that providers have to face, I think that it's the from a customer standpoint, I can't control those challenges. I can only control the value I seek for my members.
All right. Thank you. It would seem counterintuitive to me that we get higher prices from the big providers as opposed to the little ones. It doesn't seem to work in other businesses. What's going on?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very, very good question. And I think part of it is when it comes to the smaller providers, it's population. You're having to spread more costs because there are a certain amount of fixed costs in a hospital that you have to address, whether it's your folks dealing with quality or your nursing staff. You have to spread those costs over a smaller population. So that, I think, impacts margin.
So I must have misunderstood. I thought I heard you say that the costs are much higher with the urban ones. Did I misunderstand?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I think the profit margins are higher with the urban hospitals. But
the unit costs?
The per unit cost, we have not done a specific comparison between what a service costs for an urban versus rural hospital.
All right, and a follow-on question. Is there an impact here in the increase because of more sophisticated equipment, MRIs and such, and particularly in the urban centers?
Mr. Chairman, I think there is an impact, and I think that's one of the things driving medical inflation in this country is that we get more sophisticated, we buy more sophisticated equipment, and there is inherently a cost to that. I think that from my perspective, and I'm giving you my opinion here, we're very fortunate because 30 years ago there are many services that were not provided in Alaska that are now provided in Alaska. And we need to be grateful that many of our residents can now be cared for at home. That's a very good thing. But the question then becomes, how much have we grown, and have we grown too much for us to afford? Because at some point it becomes very difficult to spread those costs over a small population base, and therefore the cost of those services is much higher, and the provider's performing a much smaller number of those services. So I guess my concern would be we've grown, we do more here, but maybe we do now enough here.
Yeah, and certainly a concern is that we're doing more than's needed, more sophisticated and expensive equipment, and that's of course a judgment of the treating physician, but I worry about that. Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of my questions were answered. That 9% change in unit pricing is what concerns you. What I'm hearing you almost say, perhaps, maybe you can disabuse me of it, is that we are getting more sophisticated and maybe we can't afford it, but I still think it's still that aspect of population. A lot of our population is going outside of Alaska for treatment still, and so even though we're able to treat in Alaska, we still don't have our population necessarily confident in the services that are performed. Are you suggesting that, in your comment, that in order to get a handle on change pricing, we might need to be paying for our members to actually be going outside for treatment?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I'll address that in a couple of ways. First of all, please don't take my comments to mean that I don't think it's a good thing that we have grown and have the services that we have. I think it's a very good thing. I just think the question of whether or not we can afford to continue to do more and more and more here that's not being done here now is one that we must consider. I think the answer to that question is really going to be dependent upon the circumstances, what the community wants to have and what they're willing to pay for, what the service is, And if in, and certainly the financial health of the provider that's bringing it. So I'm not trying to make a generalization that we should not do more that we should not have more services done here. But I believe that we're at the point with our costs where we have to question whether or not there's value in continuing to bring more and more here. So that's my statement. And with respect to the whether or not we should send people out of state, let me first tell you what other companies, large companies, are doing and sort of where the trends are going in the country and then how we might fit into that. Many large employers are now starting to contract with centers of excellence or centers of value, whatever you call them, for certain procedures. Now, why are they doing this? Because those facilities can demonstrate with data that their outcomes are better and their prices are lower. And it makes sense then for a company to say, for cardiac procedures, as Boeing has done, I'm going to send all my employees to Cleveland Clinic. And Walmart's doing the same thing. Walmart has identified 5 major medical centers in the country. They're sending their employees to those major medical centers for orthopedic procedures and cardiac procedures. There are other employers, many of them, doing the same thing. Now, again, why are they doing this? They're doing it because those major medical centers, and we're talking the Mayo Clinics, the Geisingers, the Cleveland Clinics of the country, can demonstrate better outcomes with a better cost structure. Now, the way they're managing this from an employee standpoint is to eliminate deductibles and copays, eliminate any employee out-of-pocket cost if they choose that facility, but continue to cover them if they choose to get the care elsewhere. So they're contracting based on value. Now, when it comes to Alaskans, what do I think? Well, I think, first of all, it's very important that we have services available locally. I believe we need to support locally delivered health care. But at some point, when the price of that locally delivered health care and when the value we're getting from it becomes, when the difference between the value we get from it here versus elsewhere becomes very significant, I think we have to question whether or not we need to give employees other choices. We've had procedures here where what is usual and customary, we pay at 90% of the usual, customary, and reasonable charge. But we've had procedures, and I'm not going to identify the community or the procedure because that would not be the right thing to do. But where that charge has been 36 times the UCR in Seattle. So sometimes when we're talking about price divergence, we are talking about such a huge margin that it almost becomes unconscionable to pay that huge margin. And so do I think we need to look at contracting for value? Yes, I do think we need to look at contracting for value. Do I hope that our local providers will step up and provide us with that value? Absolutely, I do. That's a general statement. Now, when it comes specifically to, I think, some of the specialty procedures we're talking about.
Second, before you go on, Senator Geisel has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, though honestly, I believe the commissioner may be getting to my point. Last week, Deputy Commissioner Barnhill talked about our providers acting rationally mm-hmm. in an economic sense. And I think you're getting to the point that in Alaska, yes, we have some wonderful specialists who have arrived here, but there's little, if any, competition in some of these venues, which causes that provider to act rationally, that is, charge what the consumer will bear, so to speak. And it's created a skewed economic situation. And so by offering care, some of the insurance companies are doing this, sending their beneficiaries outside, it creates a competitive environment that may help drive costs down. But I think you may be getting to that, Commissioner. I'll let you proceed.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, you're absolutely correct. So, I believe we said last week, we are not blaming providers for what they charge. They are as the senator said, they're acting rationally in the market that we've provided, and in which government pays about 60% of that bill. So, from our standpoint, we're in some ways part of the problem because we just continue to pay. So, but as an employer then, we need to begin to act rationally and to say, at some point, it doesn't make sense to continue to pay escalating costs. We have a specialty where our per unit cost went up in a year something like 40%. And when we see those kinds of cost increases, we need to begin to consider whether or not we're acting rationally within the market as well.
Commissioner, excuse me, on a national level, in cities that have more than one major provider, big hospital, has their cost escalation been less than places like Juneau here where there's only one?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I don't have any empirical evidence or studies to point you to, but I'll tell you that in a highly competitive market, costs generally tend to be lower. We are seeing consolidation in the healthcare market, and consolidation can be both positive and negative. Consolidation can bring you the ability to contract for a bundled payment, all the payment wrapped into one service. But consolidation, too much consolidation in a market, can lead to monopolistic pricing.
Yes.
And so we see that not just in our market, but in some large cities, even in the lower 48, there's been so much consolidation that they're seeing price increases because of that consolidation.
Thank you.
I want to make, Mr. Chairman, one more point with respect to medical tourism, which has been, you know, covered quite a bit and in the newspaper, and I believe is just kind of becoming a fact of life in healthcare, not just in our state but in our country. Healthcare is one of the most personal things that we can deal with. When it affects our families and in a profound way, it's the most important thing in an individual's life at the time. And I feel like we have an obligation from a plan standpoint to provide the best information to our employees and the best access to care from both a quality standpoint and from the plan standpoint, from a cost standpoint. What do I mean by that? If you or a loved one are facing a serious medical challenge, you probably want the best access to the best treatment for that particular condition. And very often the best treatment for that, first of all, it's sometimes difficult to find. Who provides the best quality of care? The best medical centers in the country are providing that data. Let me share a personal experience with you. About 4 years ago, my husband had a pretty significant heart surgery. It was a surgery he had to travel where they recommended he travel out of state. We went to the Mayo Clinic. I did research looking at a couple major medical centers in the country and could find data on the mortality rate for that specific procedure for his specific demographic, and I made a choice based on that. And there was a huge difference. There is a huge difference in outcomes when it's someone you love between a 1% mortality rate and a 3% mortality rate. And let me tell you, I believe we need to give our employees the ability to make that choice when it's their loved one, to be able to give them the option to go to the center of excellence without suffering significant out-of-pocket costs, especially when that care is likely going to save the plan money. So in my mind, giving people the ability to travel especially when it's going to save the plan money, is not just the right thing to do from the plan standpoint, but it's the right thing to do for our employees when they're facing a significant medical situation in their lives.
Commissioner, back to Representative Isaacson's excellent question here. When we have a preferred provider, as we do, how much does that limit the employee's choices of where to go?
Mr. Chairman, only right now in one no, the answer is no. It does not limit their choices. It may make their out-of-pocket costs greater. But right now, we really don't have much of a preferred provider. We have a network in Alaska, but we don't have penalties or for employees choosing to go out of network, except for with our two Anchorage hospitals, because we really don't have that much competition in the state where we can provide that structure. We need to look at doing that because that's how you really drive high network participation or high participation by your employees in your network, is to put a structure in place where you pay 90% of if they go in network and something much lower if they choose to go out of network. Our structure right now, we have that structure right now only for the Anchorage hospitals, but not for other providers and specialties. What does end up happening, though, is that if employees go out of network, very often they get what's called a balance bill. Now, we pay at 90% of usual, customary, and reasonable charges in a market. If a provider is in network, then they're agreeing to bill us at that UCR, what's called UCR rate. So our employees won't get a bill for charges above that rate. However, very often if you go to a network, a physician who is not in network, they may charge more than our plan pays. And in that case, the employee gets a bill. And that bill, sometimes, I've seen bills because we've gotten employees expressing concern about them in the thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question coherently. But I understand the value of choice, definitely. I understand the value of being fiscally restrained in what kind of charges we're going to pay for. And saving our money. But I also understand that we need to induce somehow, and since it's state money being involved with this, we need to induce our industry's ability to meet the needs of our people in state. I'm from a smaller community than South Central, and we don't have the population, and we do have the medical providers have to amortize their equipment and so forth. But if you don't have that equipment, when there's an emergency, you miss that equipment, and that 1-3% mortality rate now increases because we didn't have something that was necessary at that moment. That's why a small community keeps a fire department. People don't need the ambulance or they don't really appreciate the ambulance until they need the ambulance. Have you talked with the industry providers about centers of excellence and about what they can do in the outlying areas, in the hub communities throughout Alaska that do provide medical? I know we have a growing centers of excellence in certain areas in Fairbanks, and I know there's a new hospital or facility out in Nome and Bethel and so forth. Have you talked to the hubs about what their needs are in relationship to restraining cost so that we can really prefer them in that sense and help them provide for the needs of our citizens?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, very good points and very good questions. And I think, and these are issues that are difficult and we're going to have to struggle through because you're absolutely correct. It's very difficult in a smaller community to have a financially sustainable hospital. It's a much more of a challenge with a smaller population base than with a larger one. We've had many conversations with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I've had conversations with the Bartlett Hospital here, with Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna, and those conversations are ongoing. With respect to other smaller hospitals, I have met with the hospital association itself, but not necessarily with the executives of all the smaller facilities. I'm certainly open to doing that. I've expressed an openness to the Hospital and Nursing Home Association to meet with any of their members who want to meet with us to talk about these issues. I think there are some really innovative ideas that are coming from some of those providers, and we want to support those innovative ideas, whether they're innovative ideas around how we contract with them and how we pay them or other issues. One thing I think that sometimes isn't known, because hospital pricing is such a difficult, complex, and not well understood process, that sometimes there's not an awareness even of the delta between their cost for a service and what the cost for that service could be somewhere else. I mean, when you're talking about sending someone out of state, you're talking about paying for them, a ticket for them, a ticket for a family member, a hotel, lodge, I mean, transportation. So there's a big, there's a pretty big expenditure just in the travel. So sometimes I think it's just simply a lack of awareness or understanding of what their pricing structure is for certain procedures compared to others. Because what we found sometimes is for some things, some of our smaller hospitals are very competitive for some services, but for others they may be double or triple, and they may not even be aware that of that pricing structure. So I think that's where we can help in some ways, is to say, you know, why would it, if I'm paying $6,000 for a colonoscopy here and $2,000 in Seattle, there might be a bit of a concern there. But if we can at least raise that issue and say, are you aware that this is what this procedure would cost here versus Seattle, perhaps that could help them evaluate whether or not their pricing structure is competitive.
Representative Keller has a question, and Representative Hughes.
Thank you again for your presentation. Thanks for sharing your personal story. Did you, when you did the research on where to go, you know, looking for a center of excellence, did you find that information easy to find, like to find the comparable mortality rates for a given procedure? Where'd you look for that? And did you feel when you got done that you had you had a really good confidence that you had covered all the possible centers of excellence that are available to you when you got done searching?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think that information is on quality is becoming more available. This was four years ago now. And I could find quality data on not all of the major medical centers I looked at, but three or four, enough to give me confidence in the choice that we made. But that data is not readily available for all major medical centers. I think that's something that we can push our providers to do. We want to see your quality outcomes, and not just the ones mandated by the federal government. We want to see more, because there are certain quality metrics that are reported to and required by Medicare and other federal agencies. But sometimes, you know, that data tends to be more general. But if you're looking for a specific procedure, it's not always easy to find that. And I think the more we can encourage that data to be published, the better job we'll be doing for our members, who then have better information available to help them make decisions.
Representative Hughes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. I was wondering, when you have you discover that a unit pricing is vastly different, you mentioned something about 40% higher or maybe 36 times higher in one case, are you communicating with providers so that they know, or is it just they kind of pick up on it when you are choosing for a certain thing to send them outside? Is that readily available information to providers in the state so they're aware of that? And are you seeing some adjustment where they are bringing their prices down? Are we starting to have that impact? And then do you adjust the UCRs based on what you find outside, and then that is causing in-state prices to come down?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, first of all, for all the kind of hoopla around medical tourism, we've had a travel benefit for many years, and we've not yet expanded it. So we're doing nothing. We're not taking any different action than we were. We're talking about it more. And we're talking about how we could expand that benefit or how we could contract based on value. But from a practical standpoint, we don't choose to send people out of state. People make those choices themselves. And we can do even a better job, I think, of providing them with good information on pricing. But at this point, we're not recommending that people go out of state. We're just giving people have that ability already. And they have for some time through our plan. So I just want to clarify that. With respect to the pricing variation, I wish I could tell you that we are sophisticated enough and have the resources every time we identify a huge pricing variation to go out and proactively address that with providers. That we don't have the staff capacity to do that, other than, as I said, When we identify, when it comes to our attention that there's a large pricing variation, we can sometimes reach out to a provider. That is primarily handled through our third-party administrator and the network that they bring. Those are really conversations about the network, because once we identify that we're having a really a bad experience, by bad I don't mean in terms of quality, I just mean in terms of cost, with a particular provider or subset of providers, very often our network will reach out to them and ask them to join the network. And quite frankly, the answer is very often no. We don't have many specialists in the networks, in our network. Specialists in general, and I'm making a generalization because there are some in-network specialists, but in general, specialists have not joined networks. So I wish I could tell you that we had a more methodical way of approaching this issue, but at this point we don't.
Representative Hughes, follow up.
Follow up. You mentioned it was time for the employer to begin to act rationally in the market, and it seems like you could have an impact on those prices, and you haven't changed the travel policy, but it seems like you should be making, if something is $2,000 as opposed to $6,000, that if we were to do that, we could impact and help bring the cost down in the state, but you've decided not to proactively do that. Is that what I'm understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, no, we've not decided. We've actually, I think, started the process of acting proactively by beginning the conversation. But the conversation then needs to be followed by plan changes. And we, as I mentioned last week, our focus right now until probably the end of the spring is getting a new third-party administrator on board through a fairly massive RFP that we've issued, and until we get through that process and have a new vendor on board, we are holding off on making any major plan changes. We just don't have the staff resources, quite frankly, to be pursuing multiple paths at once. So we're looking at what we can do when we have a new vendor partner on board. We also won't know exactly what our vendor partner will bring in terms of a Centers of Excellence model. There are many providers now bringing those networks to their clients. And so we may gain, our network will possibly change. It may not change. If our current vendor prevails, then we'll have certainty in a vendor partner and we can move forward, but our network may not change or may not change significantly. But we don't know what our vendors are going to bring.
For the record, Senator Wilkowski and Senator Coghill joined us about 8:35. Thank you. And is this a good time for you to answer your question?
Yes.
Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Commissioner, I appreciate that you have started the dialogue with the providers and you're engaging in the thought process with us. The one thing that, and it's probably more of a statement than a question, is that I would encourage you is, in answering Representative Keller and partly in answering Representative Hughes, you mentioned the data reporting requirement. And there's perhaps a difference between requiring and encouraging in order to incent the pricing down. If we require, the unintended consequence might be that we actually drive up the cost for the local user, because now they may, like you, not have the staff currently, but will have to hire on more staff in order to do all the regulatory compliance issues. And that's an unintended consequence that I would hope we're not trying to drive you towards. But to continue with the direction you're going, I do encourage that part.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I completely agree with you. I think the last thing that our provider community needs right now is additional mandates. But I think we can, our ability to influence and to have an impact in the market is through our choices. And I think that's why we need to choose to contract for value. We need to choose to reward innovation by virtue of our business, not necessarily by regulation. So I hope that alleviates your concerns. I'm not here promoting more regulation, certainly.
Senator Giesel has a question.
Commissioner, along those very lines, one of the things I ponder is the constraints that the state itself puts on competition through a program we call Certificate of Need, which constrains competition And sometimes a smaller entity, such as a surgery center, actually can provide lower cost, high quality care, and yet we constrain that. What is the option for a smaller surgery center to get into your network of preferred providers, even in a venue such as Anchorage?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, certainly the best ability to get into our network right now is through our third-party administrator and the network that they bring to us. But we've had conversations. I've had conversations specifically with surgery centers about the services they provide. And as we get through this process with our TPA third-party administrator, and we have a new vendor on board, then we'll be able to continue those conversations. But I'm interested in contracting directly as well as through the third-party administrator and the network that they bring. So it remains to be seen whether or not we'll have the ability to do that through this process with our third-party administrator. But we're considering that.
Your previous experience really equips you to do this job well. Most of us know that in the big providers, maybe all of them, there's quite a bit of cost shifting, you know, when they have some services that don't cover their costs and so on. So when you sit down or our provider sits down to negotiate with them, would it be appropriate to say, we want to pay your costs and a reasonable profit, but we're not interested in paying the cost shifting that you do for this particular procedure, overpaying you there in order to cover your losses in another area?
Mr. Chairman, you raise a good point about how medical pricing is with large providers, hospitals specifically, which is very often there are parts of those facilities that don't make money at all. As a matter of fact, they lose a significant amount of money, and they rely on other services to cover those losses. Now, that's an internal business decision that they're making. And we don't get to see inside their books, and nor do I think it would be appropriate for us to necessarily look inside their books. But there's a significant amount of cost shifting that goes on, not just within services in a hospital, but also among payers. And that's another issue that I think is important to note, that there are some payers, Medicare is one, where the hospital's not necessarily recouping all the cost of providing the care. And so they shift that cost to insurers and other commercial payers, like the state's plan. So in a sense, we're paying the bill for others as a commercial payer. Now, that's just sort of a reality of the system that exists. I think in a sense, we've made the decision as a society, and I think it's a good decision, that we're not going to turn away people who need care. Anyone can go to a hospital emergency room and they can get care. And so I do have some sympathy for hospitals in that they have to take a large number of patients who will never pay. And they have to spread that cost somewhere. We end up paying for it. So in answer to your question, yes, that cost shifting occurs. How much control over it can we have? I don't know. But I think what we do need to do is identify those business models that are working really well, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a surgery center, whether it's something else, and work on contracting our services toward those business models that we think are functioning well.
Just a follow-up question, and I appreciate the quality of the questions that are going up here, that obviously folks care and know something. So I would suspect that our state employees do not visit the emergency room near as often as lots of other populations. And if you and Mr. Punkett are successful in getting all of us to be healthier, less obesity and so on and so forth, can you go to the provider and say, you know, we're not plugging up your emergency room where the cost recovery is poor and we're getting a healthier population, give us a break on costs?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're talking about some really innovative payment models, and I think we would like to see some innovative payment models in our provider community. We would like to see to be able to contract based on our covered lives and to say, you take care of this population for us, and we'll pay you X number of dollars per member per month for taking care of this population. Now, how, you know, we expect quality care, we expect good outcomes, but that kind of payment structure provides an incentive for the provider to keep those folks out of the emergency room and provides an incentive for and is of value to us. We are, I think, beginning to see some more innovative payment models emerge in this market, but not significantly. We don't have accountable care organizations in Alaska. We don't really have bundled payments for to any great extent in Alaska. Bundled payment is when you pay, if you've been to a hospital, usually you get a bill from the hospital, you get a bill from the anesthesiologist, and you get a bill from the surgeon, and you may get other bills. Mm-hmm. But a bundled payment is one bill for everything. And we would like to contract using the bundled payment approach. There's certainty for the payer, but what that requires is that all those entities that are now getting separate bills get together to determine what one bundled payment is going to look like. And that is a challenge, I think, in this market. But we'd like to see some of those innovative payment models emerge, because I think that's really what's going to help drive our costs down. Because right now, as we talked about last week, we have the provider, the payer, and the patient, and their financial interests are not aligned. And until we can get them in alignment, we're going to continue to see this runaway cost escalation. Now, we have a responsibility for that in ensuring that our employees have skin in the game, which at this point they do to some extent, but not a great not a great extent. And we'll talk a little bit more, I think, in some of these case studies, hopefully, about that. But we need to all three of those entities have to be in financial alignment, because if the provider is not sensitive to cost, and if the patient is not sensitive to cost, then what happens is costs go up, and we end up with unsustainable cost growth.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis.
You know, and I'm not sure if this has to do with the cost, but as a patient myself, I'll tell you what, getting a bill from the doctor, getting a bill from the x-rays, getting a bill, it is so difficult to keep up. I mean, I am a legal guardian to my father-in-law who has lots of care, and I get all these bills. As the patient, you can't even be sure if they're correct or not. The thing is, you got to pay them, the insurance company pays them, you don't even know what's there. I mean, we have a real problem, and I suspect it's nationwide. It's certainly not a statewide issue, but that's part and parcel of the problem. Even as a good consumer, it's difficult to determine the breakout and whose responsibility, and they just keep coming, you know, especially if you have something big that happens, it's really difficult to keep up with.
Through the chair, Representative Gass, you're absolutely correct, and we can't expect people to be good consumers in that environment, mm-hmm. which is why, as the payer and as in this case the employer, we need to do a better job until the system changes of helping our members be better consumers.
Yeah, and just Senator Wilkowski.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good discussion. I'm just wondering, though, we seem to be lumping everyone together, 100% of the employees, when if I look ahead to your next chart, what it appears to me is that 5% of the people are costing about 60% of the costs. 15% of the people are generating 80 plus percent of the costs, if I'm reading this correct. So, I mean, to say, you know, we certainly want to crack down on the arthroscopic surgery costs and other minor procedures, but it seems to me that the overwhelming majority of the costs are by a very small number of people. And I'm wondering if there are specific areas, what do we do to solve that? Mm-hmm. That's really the cost generator.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, very good observation, and we moving on to the next slide. You're absolutely correct. And this is a very typical model for most large health plans, where you have the top 5% of your population driving almost 60% of your costs. And we kind of look at this in three different bands. It's not articulated up there. But this, the bottom band, these are the folks that you want to, that are generally have good health status. They may have some underlying risk factors, but generally their health status is good. We need to keep them healthy. The next two bands up are the folks that likely have an underlying chronic condition, and we need to help them manage that condition. Because what we want to avoid is the people getting to the top of this pyramid. So part of our wellness strategy is keep people healthy in the bottom band. The next two bands, we need to help these people manage whatever conditions they might have. And that's a challenge. That's a big challenge, especially if their chronic condition is not something that impacts their daily living. It becomes more difficult to encourage folks to manage that. But nevertheless, we need to care for that population. Then when people get up into the higher bands, then we're talking about really good care management. How do we support these people who are already very sick in making the best choices for their care? And that's another strategy that we have, is managing that high-cost care. Because, as Senator Wilikowski noted, that's absolutely what's driving the bulk of our costs.
Representative Hughes.
Could you elaborate, what is that plan for that top? You said you have strategies. What are you doing differently for that group than for the rest as far as care management?
I think, through the chair, Representative Hughes, I think I'm going to defer that question to Emily if she can take that on.
Yeah. Hi, Emily Cotter, the Strategic Initiative Health Coordinator, and through the chair, Representative Hughes. So the third-party administrator currently has something that they call case management, which is case management or care management. And it's a dedicated group of employees within the third-party administrator, HealthSmart, that identifies members who are experiencing high costs and high utilization of services. Many of the employees have a nursing background or some sort of clinical background, and they reach out to the member who's undergoing these different medical services, and they try to review the services with them, help kind of coordinate care, make sure that potentially they're not getting multiple diagnostic tests, the same kind of tests over and over again, because when you enter the system, and I just went through it a couple of months ago with a very close family member who had a heart attack, you're seeing potentially three or four different specialists in a hospital setting, and it's not necessarily coordinating with your primary care physician when you get back home. So really trying to help coordinate all of these different services and make sure that the member is getting the most appropriate care, and then helping kind of connect the dots if those dots are not well aligned, if that makes sense.
Representative Hughes, to continue.
So it's a proactive outreach where they're making phone calls. You're not waiting for the patient to come to this nurse.
Precisely. And the patient can come if they feel like they need, if they are experiencing kind of difficulties and need support, they have that option. But case management is proactive in coordinating with patients.
Continue.
And was there a period of time when we didn't have this, so we know that this is actually bringing those costs down? Or is there data around the nation that shows that it's working? I'm assuming it is helping. I was just wondering how helpful and if there's more that could be done.
Through the chair, we do get estimates in the quarterly reports provided by our third-party administrator outlining what the cost savings are associated with that program. I joined the division about 6 months ago, so I am not familiar with what the savings that we were receiving before then, but I can certainly go back and find that information for the committee, as well as the estimated savings that have been reported to us for the past year.
It's always difficult in any industry to quantify cost avoidance and so on. Senator Giesel.
You know, I'm really thrilled to hear that you're looking at that model. The Alaska members of the American Academy of Pediatrics visited me recently and reminded me of the experience I had in a local facility in Anchorage that implements that model. And the cost savings and the satisfaction from the client, the patient, as well as the providers that kind of management model provides. And it doesn't have to be managed by the highest cost medical professional. In other words, it doesn't have to be a physician. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of things that nurse practitioners, PAs, and RNs can do, and we underutilize that level of professional in many of these management models. So I'm glad to hear that the state is moving to that. It also illustrates, again, for me, the fact that when government enters into a market, we don't respond in a nimble manner the way a competitor or a free market implements new ideas and change. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. So we've kind of discussed the next two slides. These are some illustrations from two different data sources of some of the variation that we see in pricing. So I'll highlight a few things and answer any questions. This slide comes from claims data from our former UCR provider, Ingenix. We now use Fair Health. This was captured probably about a year and a half ago, but the data was still, I believe, accurate. So it shows the difference between what a charge would be, what the 90% usual customary and reasonable charge would be for the 981 area, which is Washington, the Seattle area, and the 995 area, which is Anchorage. These are only physician fees, so this does not include hospitals and facility fees. And we picked some procedures where there was a pretty high variation, so not all are this high, but these are also not the highest variations. So you can see the difference for a total hip arthroplasty for the physician fee, it's a little over $5,400 in Washington, $12,000 in Anchorage. Kidney stone, fragmenting of kidney stone, $2,100 versus $8,200. So just gives you an order of magnitude of some of the cost differences that we see, which we've kind of already covered. The next slide would be familiar to Representative Keller. This is this data comes from a study that the Healthcare Commission did by a company called Milliman. And the study, which is very, I would encourage you to look at it, it's on the Healthcare Commission's website, it's very, very comprehensive. This is just one slide from it, showing commercial.
Commissioner, what do the percents mean? Percent of what?
Mr. Chairman, the methodology of the study took six states, Alaska, Idaho, North Dakota, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. And it looked at a variety of physician charges in those states. And I believe that they might have done hospital, might have been more than physician charges as well. But this is this is just the physician fees. And they did an average across those six states of what the costs are for a particular specialty or area of practice in this case. And then they pegged that average at 100%.
Okay.
And then they looked at what the costs were for each state based, comparing it to that average.
I got it.
So you can see the average, so Alaska for pediatrics is 139% of the 39% over the average, and you can look at them at the other specialties. So what does this tell us? I mean, we know we're more expensive, and we expect to be more expensive, and there's a certain cost that we pay, as we all know, because we live in Alaska. But I think the most significant thing to take from this slide is to look at pediatrics, family practice, internal medicine, where we're about 1.5 times what, or 50% more, maybe what you would pay in a comparable state. But we look down at some of the specialties, and our costs are double. You look down at interventional cardiology, and we're at 474%. That's where our concern is. Our concern is that overall we're much more expensive, but in certain areas we're very expensive. And those are the areas we need, I think, to focus on first. Not to say that, not making a judgment on what the appropriate level is that we should pay over that five-state average. Again, I think we just need to act as rational players in the market, and it's not our decision. It's not our determination about what level of profitability is sufficient. But I think we do need to look at whether or not when we're paying 474% of that average, if that's a good value for the state.
Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
So we've talked about some of these things. I'm just going to run down this. I think talked about these concepts already. So what's constraining our market? Why are we seeing the cost experience that we're having, which is that we're higher than everybody else and we're still growing? And a couple of items to highlight. Lack of alignment of interest between payers, providers, and patients. We talked about that. Lack of transparency in price and quality. We talked about that a little bit as well. We have limited competition for some of these because of our small population size, but that, of course, impacts pricing. When you, as you all know, when you have one or two providers in a market, your pricing is going to be different than if you have 50. And then I think the last one is one that we haven't talked as much about, but I think it's important to note. If you look at the study the Institute of Social and Economic Research did on healthcare costs in Alaska in 2011, and you look at who's paying for healthcare, when you add up all of the government sources of payment, Medicare, Medicaid, VA, and then commercial pay for governments, which includes cities, state of Alaska, et cetera, it's about 60% of the market. So in a sense, we have a market that, as government, we're helping to drive. And so we have to change if we're going to expect different outcomes in the market.
Representative Keller.
How does that compare with the states?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
Commissioner, how does it work when a employee has, let's say, old gentleman like Bob and I, and so maybe have Medicare, and they may be a veteran, and they might be an Alaska Native? How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, I know that with our retiree program, we deal with that because we have retirees who have Medicare, which is primary, and then our plan, once retirees reach Medicare age, is supplementary. And there's a coordination of benefits element that occurs within that plan. How it works when you have multiple plans and who takes the lead on that coordination of benefits, I'm just not sure.
I know.
Representative Lynn.
I know in my own case, I've got Alaska Care because I'm a legislator. I've got Geezer Care, which is Medicare, and then TRICARE for life. So I've got all three. And as long as I'm actively employed for this state, Medicare is primary. But I always have a difficult time when I go to a medical provider for something. They always want to put Medicare is primary, and I don't know what I'm talking about. I tell them it's actually secondary. So we get into big hassles on this. But it's I'm fortunate, and other people are in my same situation, I think. And you try to get this leveled out so, to the benefit of the patient as well as the state and the taxpayers.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, certainly these coordination issues can be very complex. And I think you noted our retiree plan is secondary to Medicare, but if you're an active employee, the active plan is primary and Medicare is secondary. So it does become, I think, a bit of a coordination challenge.
Try to explain that to a clerk at a provider.
But nevertheless, in this environment, to have dual coverage, I think, is certainly fortunate for people who do have that coverage.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, I think the question you asked is one that I sure would like to get more information on, because we're in a setting. First of all, I'll tell you this. A person that I believe knows, I can't document this, but I know he works in the field all the time. He says he made the general statement that Medicaid is the payer of first choice. So if you have, for example, a full coverage guaranteed by Indian Health Service, and a patient goes to a provider, the first thing they look at is the Medicaid payment, and then in Indian Health to pick up the rest. The reason that's significant for us, of course, is that right now we're seeing this Medicaid expansion decision in front of us, which I know is a very hot issue. But a context that I'm looking at that is, I wonder how much of the total health care cost and billing will be shifted on to some of it will be shifted on to the state books, as opposed to what is now on the federal books. And understanding that whole thing, I don't pretend to understand it. I just have the question, wondering if we expand Medicaid and then the federal government reduces Medicaid spending off in the future, what was a federal obligation becomes a state obligation on our books. And it's a very significant question. And, you know, I just would like to get more information about how it's decided, who pays, and what the priorities are.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think now we'd like to shift to some case studies. We have three of them, and in the interest of time, I think I'd like to cover the state models first, and then if we have time, we can come back to the private sector model, which is the one in front of us. Emily has done the research on these and is going to lead this part of the discussion. So, what we had talked about, and as I said, if we have time, we can go back to this, is there was a fantastic speaker in front of the Healthcare Commission back in, I think it was October, November, who has written a book called The Company That Solved Healthcare. And it's basically about his experience as the CEO of a small company and controlling that company's healthcare costs. And he's had some phenomenal results in doing some very innovative things. So if you're interested in this topic, the citation for the book is down there. And if we get back to it, we can talk a little bit more about it. But I want to move to the two models that we are looking at when contemplating changes to our plan. And I want to note that we're going to walk through these two models, but there's nothing that prevents you from taking elements from both. This is not an either or. But it's two kind of philosophically different approaches to plan changes, and I think it's important just to kind of give you that overview. So the first one we're going to talk about is a value-based health plan, which uses financial incentives to encourage consumers to make better choices. And then the consumer-directed health plan, which is essentially a high-deductible plan with a health savings account. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Emily here for a bit.
Hi, good morning. So the value-based health plan is exactly what Commissioner Hallbrook described. It's a plan that was initiated by Nebraska, and I'll talk about it more in the next slide. The state of Nebraska used this plan. And again, it uses financial incentives to encourage healthy choices, and those are structured in the plan design itself. The other approach that we've seen states and a lot of private organizations taking is a consumer-directed health plan, also known as high-deductible health care plans. And these plans are exactly as they sound. They have a high deductible. For example, in 2013, a high-deductible health care plan was defined by the IRS as a health plan where the deductible for an individual was $1,250 at a minimum, and the deductible for a family was $2,500, again, at a minimum. And you see a variety of designs used throughout both the public and the private sector here in Alaska as well. And we're going to talk about what the state of Indiana did and how they designed their health care plans, because they've been particularly successful in using those. So one of the benefits of the consumer-directed health plan is that it increases price sensitivity for people who are in the plan. And I'll go into more detail on that. But I think it's important to note that when I looked at the savings that were associated with both of these different approaches, there were three factors that the savings were attributable to, and they were the same in both of these approaches. The first one was increased use of generic medication over brand medication. The second was decreased use of specialists, so increased use of primary care physicians. And the third factor was decreased use of emergency room visits. So those three factors were what the savings were attributable in both of these approaches, which I think is fascinating. So Nebraska, they used a value-based health plan. And in 2009, the state of Nebraska added a health plan to their traditional offerings. Nebraska has kind of a traditional plan that looks somewhat like ours, although with higher premiums and higher deductibles. They also have a high deductible health care plan. But they also added a plan called the wellness plan, literally. And that plan basically reduced employee share of costs for wellness, preventative, and high quality services in exchange for lower premiums. However, in order to be eligible to enroll in this plan, employees had to complete three of the tasks listed below in the prior 12 months to enrollment. And if it was an employee with a spouse, their spouse had to complete these tasks as well. The first task was to complete a health risk assessment. And this is a survey, a self-reported survey of behavior. So it would tend to ask you questions like, do you smoke? How many fruits and vegetables do you eat? Do you run? Do you know your cholesterol levels? But it's all self-reported. The second task was to complete a health education course over, again, the prior 12 months. Now, Nebraska surveyed their members to see what they would be interested in, what kind of topics. And just to give you an example of what some of those educational courses look like, they offered one that was based on cardiovascular fitness. So people would take some online classes as well as log their different hours of physical activity. Another was a nutrition course. So people would, again, kind of keep a food diary and interact with these online courses. However, they provided other options for people. For example, people who were had a chronic disease could sign into kind of a chronic disease management program where they basically met with a wellness coach or a health coach, I think three times over the 12-month period to talk about how they were managing their condition. So not all of the tasks, not all of the health education courses that were required, you actually had to take courses. You could instead choose to meet with a professional to specifically talk about your particular health concerns. The third task that they were required to complete was a preventative visit to a primary care physician, but really submittal of biometrics. And biometrics are your cholesterol levels, your hypertension levels. There's a list of different health indicators taken from a blood test and other exams. So submittal of that. So if employees completed all three of those tasks over the 12 months prior to open enrollment, they were then allowed to, eligible to enroll in the wellness plan. So what happened with the plan? Well, it's a fairly new plan. Again, it was just started in 2009, but they've seen over 30% participation in 2011, and I was talking to somebody in Nebraska, and they said they're expecting over 46% in 2012 is what they experienced. The wellness plan offers much lower premiums than the traditional plan, so it's very attractive to people, and those premiums are based largely on the plan's experience. So because people are utilizing care in a different manner and potentially healthier to begin with, their plan experience is lower. I did ask them if they had a healthier population than the other plans, and they said that when they first opened the wellness plan, they saw mostly kind of healthier employees enrolling in the plan, but lately they've seen that change, and they've seen a much broader spread of employees with higher risk indicators coming into the plan. In 2010 and 2011, Indiana experienced premium increases of less than 1% for all of their plans, which is phenomenal. And they estimated that the return on investment was, 2.7 to 1. So, and again, those savings were attributed to the three items I mentioned below: increased generic use, reduction of ER visits, and reduced use of specialists. So, looking at a different approach, we're going to look at the state of Indiana now. And what Indiana did was they implemented what's called a consumer-driven health care plan, which is essentially a high-deductible health care plan that I talked about earlier. In Indiana, they created what they called CDHP1, which is Consumer-Driven Health Plan 1. And they implemented that in 2006. And under that plan, an individual had an annual deductible of $2,500, and the families had a deductible of $5,000. Now, Indiana also contributed to what's called a health savings account. And these health savings accounts are directly connected to the high deductible health care plan. They're a little bit different than some of the health savings accounts you might have heard of before, like the flexible health savings account or the health reimbursement account. These HSAs are specifically tied to high deductible health care plans, and they offer really some different options.
It isn't the employees' contribution to the health savings plan pre-tax dollars?
Yes.
And they can be rolled forward?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
One of the big differences is that this plan does roll, this health savings account does roll over on an annual basis, allowing an employee to accumulate their savings. It's also portable, so the employee can take it with them, and employers can contribute to the health savings account along with employees on a pre-tax basis. So in Indiana, the state contributed between 45% and 50%, depending on the year, of the deductible for those in the high deductible health care plans to their health savings account. So for example, for an individual, the state contributed around $1,250, and for a family, they contributed around $2,500.
Representative Hughes.
With that, was primary care covered, or would they have to pull that out of the individual health savings account? Because I've heard that some provide that and some don't, and if you don't, then they're apt to put off things that might become more chronic down the road.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, in Indiana, they did cover primary care or preventive care with no application of copay or deductible. And I think that's one of the key things I've seen. There's a lot of different high deductible health care plans out there, and the spectrum of what they offer and what they cover varies greatly. But two of the important factors I've seen in successful high deductible health care plans is that the employer does contribute, and that preventive care, that copays and deductible are not applied to preventive care, and that that's communicated clearly to the employees so that they understand that they can get those services without having it affect their deductible.
I'm going to ask the committee members to hold our questions, let these folks get through, and at the end of it, I'd like you to tell us what we can do to help.
Thank you. So in 2007, Indiana added a second consumer-directed health care plan called CDHP2, very creative, and this one had slightly lower deductibles and higher premiums. So rather than paying $2,500, an individual their deductible was $1,250. Family, it was 50% as well. But they did experience higher premiums as a result. So looking at the results, Indiana saved money. In a case study I was looking at, in 2001, the savings for both of the consumer-directed healthcare plans averaged 10.7%. You saw higher savings in the plan with higher deductibles and slightly lower savings in the plan with lower deductibles. And they estimated that that was between $17 and $23 million. Employees saved money. In 2010, employees contributed $7 to $10 million to their HSA in those plans. Additionally, they had built up funds over the past several years. So the total amount of unused funds in those health savings accounts were over $30 million. And that averages out to about $2,000 per employee. So employees were able to build up funds, but as part of the analysis that I didn't put up here, you also saw them accessing their funds for healthcare. So one of the elements of this that this case study looked at, which was conducted by Mercer, was are people putting off utilizing care as a result of these deductibles? And they found that that was not the case. Again, that is in Indiana. Specifically. So I think that leads us nicely into the next slide.
So what are the opportunities that we have in Alaska Care? We have a lot fewer constraints than a program like Medicaid, but nevertheless we do have some constraints. So I'm going to talk through what our opportunities are and then some of the barriers to those opportunities. The first bullet is that we've started this, is the opportunity to implement an employee wellness program. Now, we've taken the first step toward that in the last plan year. We covered preventive care at 100% for the first time, so not subject to deductible or copay. We implemented a Weight Watchers at Work program that's had tremendous success. We implemented a new tobacco cessation program that has had some success, not as many people participate as we'd like. So, and then we've formed an employee wellness committee, and we're trying to develop that grassroots support that can really create a culture of health in the work environment. That's a work in progress, but we've started that down that path. We need to work to improve consumerism and appropriate utilization of services by our members. We need to help our members by providing them with the tools to be better consumers. And this is not something that we've started. It's something that we need to look at in the next year and develop a strategy around how do we empower our members as consumers. We need to look at plan design changes that align those three critical relationships, the payer, the patient, and the provider. And that, as we talked about before, the ability to change that we have is through our contracting and through the services that we purchase. And since it's often our members going out and selecting those services, our plan design has a great deal of influence on what they select. So as we get through this process of getting a third-party administrator on board, whether it's our current vendor or a new vendor, once we get through that process, we will be looking at plan design, which is why we wanted to highlight some of the options that are out there as we look at plan design. We need to look at our contracting strategies. Are we contracting for value? Because that's the key for us, is to contract for value. And again, value is cost and quality. And then as I've referenced several times, we've just got to get through this massive procurement that we're involved in right now. Our third-party administrator contract is one of the larger service contracts that the state procures. It's often it's a difficult process for the division. It's taken all of our spare capacity for about the last 6 months, and we're not through the process yet. But we've been working on that procurement, we've been outlining what the next strategic steps are for the plan, and that's what you really see in front of you. What are the critical decisions that we need to make once we can get through this procurement and get to those decisions? So those, I think, are the opportunities. What are the barriers? First of all, change is hard. And we are really looking at, I think, to transform our healthcare market, we are really looking at transforming how people think about healthcare. For a long time, people purchased insurance, and then healthcare after that, after a fairly minimal deductible and copay, was essentially free. And I would submit to you that that's part of why we're in the situation we're in, is that lack of price sensitivity on behalf of consumers. But we still have plans, government plans in this state, where there's a $50 deductible. When healthcare is essentially free, you're not sensitive to how you're paying for it. So change, but that change is hard. We have to get people through that process of thinking about how healthcare is delivered and about how they purchase healthcare. That's just a difficult challenge. We bargain the benefit credit. And many of the changes that we're talking about could involve a change in that, potentially, that benefit credit or that structure. We're likely not, it's unlikely we're going to get those changes because we don't have a plan to implement yet in this current year's contracts, but we'll have to address that on a going forward basis through our collective bargaining agreements. We are faced with implementing with fairly limited resources. The Division of Retirement and Benefits historically has been more of a processing unit, and many of the things that we're talking about take a lot of staff time, a lot of research, and we're going to have to, recognizing that all resources are limited, we're going to have to work better and more strategically with the resources we have in order to make these changes. And we are highly visible, as you might have seen last summer when we accidentally started the conversation about medical tourism with one bullet in a slide at the ARM board, Retirement Management Board. We're highly visible. We operate in a political context. And so the changes that some employers make will not be highlighted as much as the changes that we make. So we have to be sensitive to that. And we have to ensure that we're reaching out and working with stakeholders in this process so that they understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, which really is to ensure that our employees are getting the best quality care and that care is care that's providing good value. Because if that's one message I can leave you with, it's that those two things go together. It has to be quality care, but it has to be quality care at a price that provides a good value. So with that, this last slide just kind of outlines that philosophical approach. What's our challenge? We've got to lower that rate of growth. We're already incredibly expensive. We're incredibly expensive, and we're seeing price increases we can't sustain. We know that our current path is not sustainable. When you look at the overall impact on the state's budget, it's not sustainable. But we want to work on these issues together with the provider community. That's really important. We can't do it in isolation. We need to work with them. And again, we want to support the delivery of high-quality care that provides good value. So with that, we're happy to answer any questions. And if you have any questions or you're interested on the book, The Company That Solved Healthcare, we'll find one for you.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Becky, one of the things that we've got seen over the years is you go through the contracting process for a third-party provider. Mm-hmm. How often does that happen? And I know that it probably sometimes is based on delivery, but just kind of give us a concept of how long it takes to bargain and how long that contract may last.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's a very good question, and this is the first first time I've been through this process in my current role, and I can tell you that the process of procuring a third-party administrator essentially takes all of your excess capacity in the division from the time you start until the contract is awarded. You don't have the capacity to do anything else. And we have, by statute, we're, we are required to, we can only have that contract for a maximum of 5 years. So it's a three-year contract with, with two optional one-year extensions. We are in the fourth year of our current contract with a vendor called HealthSmart. When the contract was procured, it was procured for Wells Fargo, and then Wells Fargo was Wells Fargo's insurance or third-party administrator business was acquired by a company called HealthSmart. So we elected to go out in the, and not exercise the last one-year extension for two reasons. First is that we ended up with a vendor we didn't procure for, which I think is and they I have complimentary things to say about them, but nevertheless it was it was not the vendor we procured. And the second reason is that we, as we make some of these changes, understanding the burden that that RFP process takes, we wanted to go ahead and get some certainty on who our vendor partner would be for the next 5 years so that we could get that vendor on board or continue with that vendor if it's the current vendor, and then really begin to work on some of these strategic initiatives, because you essentially just kind of have to stop everything during this process. It's very burdensome for the division.
What can we do to help? We can send you a whole bunch more really talented people and pay them well.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and we're not in an environment, I think, where we're going to ask for any more staff. We're just going to try to work smarter. And we, I think there are a couple of things you can do. First of all, there's no statutory change on the near term horizon that I can see from my from my perspective. We're not subject to the insurance code, and I think that's an important distinction to make. Because there are some statutes, I think, that that some of the private insurers are concerned about. I'm not going to speak to them, but we're not subject to the insurance code. So we have some flexibility that some of our private insurers don't have. So I don't see any statutory changes, but I think a couple of things. First of all, just to give us the venue to continue to talk about these issues with you, I think is really, really important. And then... If you're continue to be interested in these issues, to give us the ability as we're working through this process to come to you and get your feedback as a stakeholder on, as we look at plan design, what are your thoughts? What's your feedback about that plan design? I think your advice and your counsel in that respect could be very helpful to us. And then as we look at making changes that might be, as we talked about, changes hard, then to lend your support to those changes. Because even though change is hard, we're going to need to work through that change curve so that we can develop a more sustainable system for our plan, but also for the rest of the state.
Any, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment. I appreciate that you're looking for input, and I'll just give you mine. It seems to me that the focus of the presentation, it was a very good presentation, lots of good information, but it seemed to me the focus was on increasing employee payments and making sure employees have more skin in the game. And I'm not sure the increase in costs are employees' fault. So I guess my suggestion to you, I would urge you to focus certainly on making employees vested, but also let's put more focus on controlling costs. I mean, why are medical costs skyrocketing the way they are? That's my suggestion.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I agree with you. I think we've got to look at we have to look at the core issue of cost drivers. But I think we have to do that. We kind of have two choices. We can do that through a regulatory framework, or we can do that through the ability of our plan and our consumers in the marketplace to make good choices. And just certainly from my philosophical standpoint, that's the approach that I prefer, and I think it's the approach that is going to be successful. And I want to make a distinction. When you're talking about employees having skin in the game, the beauty of the consumer-directed health plan is that that's when it comes to their health savings account, that's money provided by the employer. They can contribute additional funds as well, but that's money provided by the employer, but it's in an account in the employee's name. So they have a vested interest in how that money is spent because it's their money. And so in saying we need employees to have skin in the game and to be more price sensitive, and I can give you examples of people who've told me, you know, healthcare to me was just free, so here are the choices I made because I wasn't paying for it. I think there's a way to accomplish both those objectives.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. We need to quit. Senator Wilkowski, a significant part of the early presentation dealt quite a bit with the cost containment and so on and out and so on. Thank you very much, Mr. Lynn. Representative Lynn, anything to add?
Yeah. No, I'd like to join, I think, the rest of the colleagues here, we went both into the hall. Thank you for a very excellent presentation, both this time and the previous presentation that you made. We, all of us here, act really in two capacities. One is as legislators trying to get the best health care we can at a cost that we can afford, as we do all service. And also, all of us here at this table are consumers of health care. And so we have interest on both levels, both as legislators and both as consumers of health care. And my experience with state health care has been very positive. So I'd like to thank you very much. Is there anything else to come before the House committee? Our schedule, our next meeting is on Tuesday for the House, and our calendar is not yet finalized, so we'll let you know what we're going to be hearing. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank friends for coming over and joining us here.
Thank you. We adjourn about 9:32. We're adjourned.